And one thing I failed to announce, we are planning on doing a finance class the first 2 weeks of January. I don't have the dates fixed as of yet. I would like to use a couple of our men for that. But the first couple weeks of January, I'd like to teach a finance class right here on a Sunday night. More than likely two consecutive Sunday nights. So just kind of put that on your radar. And I think I like to look at that from a biblical perspective. And there's probably no other indicator of what's going on in our life than how we spend money. When Jesus said, for where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. There's probably not a truer statement in all of the scriptures from a practical perspective. Last week, we took some time and we started talking about our propensity as a family to run over bicycles. We've had a lot of $80 to $90 bicycles that we've run over in our driveway. My wife said the other day, she said, could we please get one of those things that you put on the back of the van so we can see where we're headed so we're not running over so many things? And what we talked about is that out of all the times that we've run over bicycles, you take the tire and all the tire has all of its own components, but it doesn't turn correctly because it's obviously out of balance. We are in an unbelievably out of balance world. We would say that maybe 5 years ago, and people say, yeah, it kind of is, but now just talking to the common man that's on the street, when you're at Lowe's, Home Depot, Home Hardware, that's what I do on the weekend. If you just start up a conversation, people just start shaking their head. Boy, it's a strange day, isn't it? Last week, we took some time. I used the illustration, said when we moved into our property, that the first day that we used this property, we blew a pipe. And what happened is that amount of pressure, what it did is it brought to the forefront weakness that was already there in the pipe, because there was an older man that lived here. He was in his 90s. He probably flushed the toilet maybe once a week, who knows, but we flushed it probably 40 times the first minute. And that amount of pressure, that amount of work on this system, it exposed weakness that was already there. I think that's what's been going on. Because of the amount of pressure, the amount of negativity, we're seeing people crack. And being a person who's on the front lines of helping people, I can say without any sort of exaggeration or hyperbole whatsoever, people are cracking out there. I see the strong getting stronger, but where there's already weakness there, I see people cracking. And so we need to take a few moments. This isn't just a sermon. This is reality. We're moving out of conceptual Christianity, out of cultural Christianity, and into this place called spiritual reality. We have to have God. We have to sense His Spirit. We have to have true wisdom. We have to put actions to our words. You heard me say a few months ago that Spurgeon said that the eloquence of Whitfield was his earnestness. Actually, wasn't a very eloquent man. The eloquence of Spurgeon was his eloquence. The eloquence, I believe, of the last 5 to 10 years has been, and even now, is authenticity. But the eloquence for pastors for the next time to come, I believe, is going to be bravery. It's good to hear a baby cry. It's going to be bravery. And So that being said, when we talk about balance, this isn't just a sermon series. It's not just a couple good messages. We have to find a sense of balance. I shared with you last week, it's why I actually wear these wristbands. These have been a lifesaver for me living in Florida, where the allergens never die. And I have struggled with dizziness most of my life. I only have an episode once every 3 or 4 years now because I've learned how to control it. I've learned how to sense when I'm having issues, and these wristbands have been very, very helpful. But I tend to struggle with dizziness, especially when Melody walks in the room. But I was at the beach one time with a friend of mine. His name was Howard Martin, and we were sitting there, and we were just talking, and as I said last week, the waves came to shore. Then all of a sudden, I started to get a little bit dizzy because my mind was setting out the message that the ground around me was moving. Obviously, the ground wasn't moving. It was the water that was moving. Last week, we said Christians and non-Christians alike were in a predicament where is the world moving? Are we to move with the world? How much are we to move with the world culturally yet stay distinct to our Christian beliefs? And because everything around us just seems to be shifting and moving, it's put us at a very odd place. In fact, when I'm on an airplane, I have to sit close to a window, and especially when coming in for a landing, if that plane's going to make a big turn, I have to have the window open. And going back to the beach scenario, what my friend told me as I was struggling a little bit standing there on the beach, He said, focus on a fixed object. And it was really great advice. It was about 10 years ago. And he was exactly correct that when I start to feel a little bit of dizziness coming on, if I'll focus on a fixed object, it'll send a signal to my brain that you're okay. And it tends to bring a sense of equilibrium. When I'm on an airplane and we start making a turn down into an airport, I've got to have that window open. I've got to try to find a fixed object. Sometimes you're just looking at the blue sky, so sometimes it's very difficult. But I've got to find a fixed object. And if I can find a fixed object, it's amazing how it helps me to maintain my equilibrium. It's actually very, very therapeutic from an instantaneous perspective. Well, I think when it comes to the Christian life, we are in a situation where we have to find a fixed object if we're going to maintain balance in this world. And that object really is, it's not just God. I believe that it's the providence of God. As a parent, unfortunately, providence has allowed me to oversee two funerals for my own children. And distinctly, I remember, especially in my early 20s, burying our firstborn, Matthew David. I remember just sitting there and in the hospital gazing upon Romans 8:28. And we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, and them are the called according to his purpose. It's the great counterbalance, is it not? Romans 8:28. It was the counterbalance for Job in Job chapter 1. We see all that he went through, all that he lost, and he said, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. He said, blessed be the name of the Lord. There's still goodness in this atmosphere. There's still goodness in the chapters ahead. There's still goodness on the horizon. But I want you to turn to Romans 8:28 for just a few moments here, because I want to look at something a little differently this morning. Life can put a lot of very difficult things on one side of the scale, but Romans 8:28 is the great counterbalance that balances it all out. And without Romans 8:28, the Bible talks about those whose men's hearts are failing them because of fear. That will be you one day if we don't have a very clear vision that the goodness of God is a thread that's running through the fabric of life. It's the backdrop of every stage upon which the props of life are set. If you look at Romans 8 and verse 28, we often focus at verse number 28. But once you see in verse number 28, the Bible says, in all things, we know that all things work together for good to them that love God, to them are the called according to his purpose. And look at verse number 29. Now, verse number 28 doesn't say that all things are good, but all things work together for good. But then what happens is what's interesting is verse number 28 tends to get all of the attention. Verse number 28 tends to get all of the play in our minds. But I really believe that if we're going to really understand Romans 8 and verse number 28, we have to move on down to verse number 30. And I believe that we can find security in verse number 30. Look, if you look at verse number 29, for whom he did foreknow, he also did predestinate to be conformed to the image of his son, that he might be the firstborn among many brethren. But then God says, moreover, whom he did predestinate. Now, I'm going to use a phrase here that in theological terms helps us, but I don't believe it better describes God. Remember, our language and our words can only do the personhood of God, the being of God, so much justice. And even though Jesus is the Word, he is the divine expression, our own words can only do the personhood of God, the being of God, the existence of God, so much justice. So I'm going to use a phrase here. That when God says, for whom he did predestinate, that's eternity past. Do you see the little play on words there that doesn't do the whole being and existence of God justice? Because eternity doesn't know time, does it not? But from our perspective, the best way that we can describe eternity before we were alive is eternity past. You may have heard me say this before, but we tend to think of God is overseeing Genesis 1, and now he's overseeing this time, and then he'll overseeing his own coming and all those things that take place in the book of the Revelation. Have you ever thought that God's not necessarily before time? God could be surrounding time? Now we get into some crazy thinking, don't we? How many of you like to think about things like this? I love to think about things like this. Just try to think things differently. Remember, I used to go for grammar classes to an old lady in our church. Her name was Grandma Judd. Her first name was Grandma. And I told her that I had an interest in writing, and I said I didn't listen very well in grammar class. I said, so I'd like you to help me with my grammar, and if you hear me speak, please let me know if I'm having issues with grammar. And she was diagnosed with cancer. I remember her telling me, we started talking about heaven one day. She's a very godly saint. And she said, I didn't used to think about heaven. She said, but I'm 89. She said, I think about heaven a lot right now in my life. I think heaven's a good place to think about. God says, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven. So I think we have to filter this life through this realm called heaven. And God says, moreover, whom he did predestinate. So that's in eternity past. Now, let's not categorize that word. When some people hear that word, they think of the word Calvinism. Well, that's a relatively new word in comparison to eternity past. So let's just set that word aside for just a few moments. I am not a Calvinist. I just try to be a biblicist. I see the sovereignty of God. I see that God foreknew us, and it's not what he knew, it's whom he knew. The Bible says, for whom he did foreknow. But just setting those things aside, because the word Calvinism is a very new word in comparison to eternity past, let's for a few moments think about the word predestinate. In that we see eternity past here. And I want us to take a few moments, if you don't mind, and go, if we can, to Jeremiah chapter 1. Jeremiah chapter 1. Jeremiah chapter 1. And what we see here, when God says, for whom he did foreknow, he did predestinate, that we were in the mind of God before time even began. I think this is extremely comforting to us this morning. There is this theological thinking out there, and it's actually very, very common, that God saves us, and we have to just be really, really glad that some preacher decided to witness to us that day, because if they didn't witness to us, we never would have been saved, and just thankfully everything fell in line so that we would come to Christ. I don't see that in the Scriptures. I see that before time even began, and this is very comforting, by the way, because no matter what time frame you're living in, no matter what happens to you, we can see that we were on the mind of God in eternity past, and we're going to see here in a few moments, in eternity future. And the question I'm going to ask you is, what did you do to get into the mind of God in eternity past? See, we think that this thing called life, it's our time frame to take things under control. And now it's a good thing that God has us. Good things that he has us for us to worry about our finances. It's a good thing that God has us so that we can worry about our health. It's a good thing that God has us so we can worry about our children. If he didn't have me, wait a second, you were in the mind of God. What did you do to get into the mind of God in eternity past? What did you do? Look what God says, Jeremiah 1:5. Before I formed thee, he says, I knew thee. And before thou camest forth out of the womb, I sanctified thee and ordained thee a prophet of the nations. Let's go to Psalm 22. We look at this as a messianic psalm. It's a psalm with very specific prophecies of the Lord Jesus Christ. But remember that it was still a human being. It was a saint that was writing these things. And his own emotions and his own experiences are definitely involved. And we see in Psalm 22, verse number 1, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? This is how Christ cried on the cross. I believe there was a separation between the Father and the Son. I believe that true separation, true death in the biblical sense is separation. So we see a separation of the Father and the Son on the cross. And he said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? Why art thou far from me? And from the words of my roaring, O my God, I cry in the daytime, but thou hearest not, and in the night season, and am not silent. But thou art holy, O thou that inhabitest the praises of Israel. Our fathers trusted in thee, they trusted, and thou didst deliver them. They cried unto thee, and were delivered, and trusted in thee, and were not confounded. But I am a worm and no man, a reproach of men and despised of the people. And all that see me laugh me to scorn. They shoot out the lip. They shake the head, saying, he trusted on the Lord that he would deliver him. Let him deliver him, seeing he delighted in him. That's actually a prophecy concerning Christ. It's what they said of Christ on the cross. He's the Son of God. He needs to get himself down. Let God deliver him. Look at the next verse. But thou art he that took me out of the womb. Thou didst make me hope when I was upon my mother's breast. I was cast upon thee from the womb. Thou art my God from my mother's belly. Look what he says there. I was cast upon thee from the womb. Thou art my God from my mother's belly. What did you do to take care of yourself when you were in your mother's womb? Look at the next verse. Be not far from me, for trouble is near, for there is none to help. I love this verse here in verse 10. I was cast upon thee from the mother's womb, and thou art my God from my mother's belly. Eternity past, what did you do to get in the mind of God in eternity past? What did you do to decide that you would be born in 1972 or in the 1960s or in 1980s or for a little no-name baby back there, January 2023? That is what we call him around the house, no-name. But just as a person is on an airplane and I have to open up the window and get my sights on a fixed object, when you start to feel dizzy, it's great advice to put your sights on a fixed object. The fixed object that we need to be looking at is the providence of God. And I dare say that without this, whatever times come, you will be in that category where men's hearts are failing them because of fear. Now, As I endeavored to speak about balance, what I did not want to do is give a self-help message. I want a God-centric message. I want to talk about balance from God's perspective. But it's one thing to intellectually say that, yeah, I've got a view of the providence of God, but then there's this daily delight in the providence of God. Your feelings being affected because of you thinking about God. Okay, that's what separates mature from immature Christians, is your feelings, your spirit being affected because you're thinking and meditating upon God. By the way, is your spirit affected on a day-to-day basis? It's the only way that we're going to be able to maneuver through this thing called life. It's the only way that we can get through this. If not, then we're just Christian fatalists. We're Christians in name, but then we're just kind of hoping that things work out well. But we need God to be our daily delight. God says of the godly man that his delight is in the law of the Lord. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 1. Proverbs chapter 1. We don't want to be those that have this Christianized, fatalistic sort of approach to life. And we're only willing to pray and to be eager about serving God and searching for God when things go awry. September 10th, 2001, my wife and I, along with our four older children, we were in Buffalo, New York, and we were visiting Niagara Falls. I all of a sudden got sick. We had to return home. It was a good thing because the next day, obviously, was September 11th, 2001. And one of those planes, by the way, according to reports, was trying to come into the Johnstown Airport, moved over Johnstown and crashed about 30 minutes away in Shanksville, Pennsylvania. Really, it's in the middle of a field somewhere. But I'll never forget one of the deacons calling me, and he said, a lot of the churches are gathering to pray. Now, I'm a little bit more amiable, a little bit more gracious now. I probably would have conceded. But the first thing that hit me is God going to be honored by all these massive amounts of people who could care less about church, all of a sudden wanting to pray because they're full of fear? And I was thinking of Proverbs chapter 1, and I think we have to take these things in account. Once again, these God-centric messages aren't really smooth on the American ear, but I think God gets them. Look at Proverbs chapter 1, verse number 29. Actually, verse number 20. Wisdom crieth without. She uttereth her voice in the streets. She crieth in the chief place of concord, in the openings of the gates. Look at verse 22. How long, ye simple ones, will ye love simplicity? And your scorners delight in their scorning, and fools hate knowledge. Turn you at my reproof. Behold, I will pour out my spirit unto you. I will make known unto you my words. Because I have called and you refuse. Boy, God is calling Americans. You can hardly turn anywhere without flipping through the radio and hearing some kind of a Christian message, seeing some kind of a Christian bumper sticker, seeing somebody witness. God is calling, but we are refusing. And you see here in verse 25, God says, but ye have said it not, all my counsel, and would none of my reproof. So God says, if you push away wisdom, now this doesn't mean that we cannot come to God in repentance. It doesn't mean that, because God says, if you find yourself far from me in the book of Deuteronomy, he says, if you seek me with all your heart, you'll find me. But God does say in this verse, I also will laugh at your calamity. I will mock when your fear cometh. And what God is teaching here, I believe, is that wisdom will not come and instantaneously clean the mess that we've created because of our habitual lack of wisdom. So in the immediate, it doesn't mean that we cannot seek after the Lord. It doesn't mean that we can't be like the prodigal son. God says, if you find yourself far from me in the book of Deuteronomy, he said, if you'll seek me with all your heart, you'll find me. But it does mean that wisdom will not come and instantaneously clean up the mess that we've created because of our neglect of wisdom. Let's go to Proverbs chapter 8 for a few moments. So the fixed object in finding balance in this world, when the ground underneath us seems to be moving, and everything around us seems to be going crazy, the fixed object of God's providence, but that must become our daily delight in the moment. I'm going to say this once again. Is your spirit affected because you're thinking about God on a daily basis? The truth is there so much competition for your spirit being affected? And I'm going to go back to this phrase. If, as a majority of a society can, they will. And there's very few people who will catch themselves and say, wait a second. I can't be amongst those that are pushing away the wisdom of God. Wisdom is crying. And just because I can be full of entertainment, I can be full of pleasure, doesn't mean that I should. But in Proverbs 8 and verse number 33, the Bible says this, hear instruction and be wise, and refuse it not. Blessed is the man that heareth me. Look what the Bible says. Watching, this is Lady Wisdom talking, as theologians would call it, because wisdom is in the feminine here. It doesn't mean that God is feminine, but the Bible here is giving is talking about wisdom in the feminine terminology. Blessed is the man that heareth me, watching daily at my gates, waiting at the post of my doors. Have you ever seen an intern or somebody that is learning a trade, and they're asking questions at every turn, at every single turn? I believe that this is the way that we're supposed to be when it comes to wisdom. Every day, observing, looking around, asking questions, getting to the Word, applying it. This is what I love about new converts. They're asking questions. They see God in everything. And the Bible says here, blessed is the man that heareth me, watching daily at my gates, waiting at the posts of my doors. For whoso findeth me, findeth life, and shall obtain favor of the Lord. Bob Goff tells a story of how when he wanted to get into law school, he was not allowed into law school, and he decided to go to the dean's office door and wait there every day. And I believe that he did this for 2 weeks. Is that correct, Melody? He did it for about 2 weeks, every day. And as that dean of the law school came in, he said, all you have to do is give the word. And he would go in his office, he'd come out, and Mr. Goff was there. Mr. Goff would say, all you have to do is give the word. You decide. All you have to do is give the word. Every day. I think the time frame was about 2 weeks. And then finally, the dean of the law school acquiesced. That's the kind of diligence that God says I believe that we need when it comes to searching out the wisdom of God and getting our minds, let's look at this again, on a fixed object. Look at verse 35. For whosoever findeth me findeth life, and it shall obtain favor of the Lord. Life, that feel, that sense. But he that sinneth against me wrongeth his own soul. All they that hate me, the Bible says, love death. So, to find balance, we have to get our sights focused on a fixed object. That fixed object, I believe, to be specific, is the providence of God. But I believe that has to become our daily delight. Now, when wisdom is your daily delight, I think that something's going to occur in your life that's going to help you to find a sense of balance. A couple nights ago, I saw Eric Keister. Eric Keister used to serve with my family. We served together in the Heart basketball program. After we left, he took it over. He is now away from the Heart basketball program. I saw him a couple nights ago, and I asked him, I said, do you ever sit back and wonder how you had so much time to oversee Heart basketball? And he said, that's exactly what I think. He said, I'm busy now. He said, I used to run this program. He said, I have no idea how I had any time to even do that. What's interesting, though, is that when somebody has a job or a business and they get involved with something that's a not-for-profit or an extreme hobby, or they're running something as a volunteer, it's amazing how everything in your life starts to shift so that you can take on that responsibility. Everything starts to shift. I remember my work schedule shifted so that I could run Heart basketball. My family life shifted so I could run Heart basketball. But everything shifted so that I could be a part of really what was a very strenuous volunteer position. You know, we're talking about balance. For us to truly find balance from God's perspective, remember, this is a God-centric message. Okay? There's a part of me, when I wanted to talk about this, I wanted to go to Zig Ziglar's teaching and talk about 20% pleasure, 20% spirituality, 20% rest, and talk about all those things. But I believe that would be missing it from God's perspective. Because what really needs to happen for us to find true balance, what I'm talking about is when you experience what Job experienced, and you have so much spiritual balance that you have the counterbalance in your life of the providence of God, and you can say, the Lord gives, and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. That counterbalance doesn't come by on accident at all. And so part of what has to happen is, just as Eric Keister is involved with that not-for-profit, and his whole life shifts around him accomplishing what he was supposed to accomplish. Our whole life, I believe, is to shift around, making God our daily delight. See, rather than conforming Christianity to your life, this sense of finding balance is about conforming your life to Christianity. Now, what does this mean for our family? Here's what this means for our family. Conforming our life to finding that fixed object at all times, knowing that no matter what happens, because let me share something with you. Here's my fear for a lot of Christians. Being a person who listens to people talk about their hardships day in and day out. Just a couple days ago, I got a call from a pastor, and that we've been turning away most clients. I decided to answer his call, especially because he was a pastor. And just listening to him go through his story, this thought's been in my mind. Remember a couple weeks ago, I think it might have been last week, and I talked about how kid-centric our world is. I said that the last generation probably needs a little bit of what we have, and this generation probably needs a little bit of what the last generation had. Our dads, 50 years ago, many of them ruled from a distance. They were very hard workers. But for many of them, they felt like if they were providing and they set a good moral tone for the family, that was their job and that was their responsibility. Around the late 80s, early 90s, a lot of relationship preaching, relationship counseling started. But it's gone to the other end of the spectrum. And so now we have this very kid-centric world, which God said would happen in Isaiah chapters 1, 2, and 3. And many of our grandfathers and many of us growing up, we could never imagine being at the ball field and the parents making sure we don't go hungry for for any longer than 20 minutes, making sure we have the proper snacks there. We play two games. After the game, we run back to the concession stands. On the way back home, we're watching videos in the van, because we can't have a dead time where children are not entertained for at least a 10-minute period. We stop and pick up pizza on the way home, and we got to hurry home, because once we get home, we got to leave for their friend's birthday party. I mean, that is life for the average American child. So I've been a youth pastor, two different churches. I was a head varsity basketball coach in Illinois, here in Florida. Coached Little League. Worked with a lot of school children. I believe I can say through experience that for some parents, their absolute worst fear, I believe I can say this, for some parents, their absolute worst fear is that their child feels bad, ever feels inferior, or ever remotely is made to feel possibly a little bit bullied by somebody else. And so what's happened is I've been really putting a lot of thought towards this. We have this society that's we're so pleasure filled, and then a pastor, a conservative pastor, stands up and says, "Hey, Christianity is about dying." We're looking at it going, why would I want to do that? Who would want to do that? So our entire message, it was the gospel message, that receiving the gospel is about being willing to die for Christ. He that taketh not up his cross and followeth after me is not worthy of me. And so our entire message to an unbelievably pleasure-filled, kid-centric society, it's coarse. It swims in a whole different direction. It's not palatable. It doesn't even rest on the ear. It doesn't even make sense. And as I said before, what we're having to do is start a restaurant in a community that has no taste buds, so we have to make sure that your friends are at the restaurant. We have to make sure there's a lot going on at the restaurant. We have to make sure that you love everything except for the fact that you really have no taste buds. Now, that's going to change in our country, I truly believe. If you study the rise and falls of nations, I believe it's going to happen very quickly. But the point being is this, is when we talk about this idea of balance, finding a fixed point and maintaining a view of that and letting that affect, and here's what I wanted to say about that. I said I'll have to say this. I don't have the confidence that the average Christian can go through something unbelievably tragic and not throw away their faith. I don't have that confidence. Because I believe that what we've done is we've taken the Bible, and being a Christian in New Testament times meant that you were probably going to be greatly persecuted or die, and the encouragement was this: Jesus is coming. That was the encouragement. Now Christianity is, really by way of inference, that, hey, God saved you, we're glad you got that far, but now God's going to make your life better when you come to our finance class and you learn about relationships, and life's going to be so much better now that you have Jesus. And the thing is that's not the message of the New Testament. In fact, life can very dramatically get worse, to be honest with you. I have very little confidence that the average Christian, if you went through the extreme trauma, I believe that they would be confused. Wait, I thought my life was going to get better. I thought Jesus was like icing on top of the cake. Like, my life was already pretty good, but now I'm really confused by this. The message of the New Testament was really this: you accept Christ, read the book of Thessalonians. They were greatly persecuted. And their encouragement wasn't, hey, go to marriage class and life's going to get so much better. It's Jesus is coming back, and boy, then it'll be good. Now, I'm just speaking as it is. But I study this and study this and study this and study this and study this. And I'm on the front lines of dealing with people's hearts and minds, listening to their confessions. But literally, we're thrown off base if we don't find a spouse by the age of 25. We're thrown off base if we don't find the job that we always wanted. I don't need to keep going, but my point is this. is Christianity is finding a fixed object in the providence of God. And then everything in our life forces itself to shift towards daily delighting in that. So what does this mean for our family? We'll speak personally. It means for us as a family. These are just some general things. It's not everything. But first of all, we established a day of worship and a day of rest as a family. That we want a day to reset our spirits. We decided years ago that we weren't going to do common everyday events on Sunday. We realized the culture is vastly and greatly putting pressure upon that. But in general, I'm not legalistic about it, but in general, we've established a day of worship and a day of rest. And we try to prepare for that day. This is like foreign languages in our country today. Sunday morning, by the way, used to be a common expression, is what? It's a Saturday night decision. That's a foreign concept. I've got two boys that are pretty extraordinary at baseball. They are frequently courted by people that want them on a travel ball team. And if that takes me away from a consistent day of worship and a day of rest, for me as a family, we've said, we're not legalistic about it, but we have said this, that if that consistently and in general takes me away from that, we're going to say no. Now here's, I want to talk about concessions for a few moments. Not the concession stand, but I want to talk about concessions. Here's the problem that I'm noticing. So the world has been crouching in on the church for years. Just crouching in. And so what happened in the 60s, they said, we just want to be able to freely express what we believe about homosexuality. So Christians went, okay, well, you stand over there and you can freely express that. And I stand over here and I can freely express it. We thought, well, there's the line. There it is. And you know what I'm noticing about concessions? They ain't stopping. Nothing's stopping. Because guess what? They started to freely express and they said, well, we actually want more rights. We want to be seen in a court of law just as heterosexual couples because we want to, now we want to have the potential to adopt maybe even some of your children or other people's children. And we're like, wait, I thought you just wanted free speech. And what's happening is that every area that Christians are making concessions, guess what? You give it an inch, they're taking a yard. And I decided some years ago when it came to a lot of different areas, when it came to Sunday, when it came to modesty, when it came to other areas, I'm just going to, as a dad, have to draw some lines. And I'm gonna try to be on the right side of history. Now, every family has to make up their own decisions. But now you see three TED Talks given where they're trying to soften the blow to pedophilia. Wait, I thought back in the 60s you only wanted free speech. Now it's not just free speech. Wait, now you really want our children because you can't produce your own children. That's what that's really all about. And the point being is this, is that with all the concessions the church has made, hey, we don't have to have shotgun approach to preaching. We don't have to have 1,000 scriptures given. We can just give a few scriptures here and there and make it life coaching with a religious emphasis. And with all the concessions that we're making, guess what? The world's just asking more. The world's crouching into the church. And I've decided, you know what? I'm going to go back and just focus on the Bible and be biblical. And I'm looking at different areas. Okay, I'll make a concession here, maybe culturally, maybe there. But you know what? When it comes to what the Bible teaches, we're going to teach the Bible, believe the Bible. But all these concessions, guess what? We're getting backed into a corner. We're on Custard's last stand right now. You can't tell me we ain't on Custard's last stand. We are on Custard's last stand. And it's time that we got offensive instead of defensive. And I think that many Christians are starting to see that that has to be the case. And we have to be unashamed when it comes to these areas. For us, to have a fixed point to daily delight as a family and individually, a day of worship and a day of rest. This is meant for us as a family. That entertainment, I don't really like the word entertainment, decompressing, pleasurable activities, is something that's tagged to the end of the day. It's not something that we do throughout the day. In fact, I can prove, I believe biblically, that that decompression is actually not very fun until you work. And one of the things that I notice about industrious families is they teach their children, hey, you can decompress. You can take part of pleasure. God has given us all things richly to enjoy. But they've taught them that that's a reward at the end of the day after giving yourself to work and sweating and earning by the sweat of your brow. Ecclesiastes 5:12 tells us that the sleep of a laboring man is sweet. And the best way I can illustrate this is if you go to somebody's house who's lazy, who doesn't work, you ring the doorbell at 12 noon, they get out of bed, and what are they still? They're still tired. They're still going, yeah, hey. Like there's no satisfaction. It's like it's quite amazing. Proverbs 25:16 says this. Proverbs 25:16 says, hast thou found honey? Eat so much as is sufficient for thee, lest thou be filled therewith and vomit it. So there's some things in life that are enjoyable, but only in increments. Those that find balance, I find that they learn to create and carve out a time in their life where they work and they labor, but they produce a platform of sweetness where you can actually enjoy the pleasure because you've worked so hard to get to that point. In this particular society, it's possible, usually on your parents' dime, but it's possible to live only for pleasure. And if you have children doing that, I think I just had a conversation with some parents this week. I said, you know, you may need to not allow them to do that on your dime. And guess what? When you have to pay your bills once a month or once a week, guess what? It's quite the reality. It's quite the teaching in reality. Now, that doesn't apply to everybody. There's some people in very, very difficult situations. But in Proverbs 25:16, the Bible says, hast thou found honey? Eat so much as is sufficient for thee, lest thou be filled therewith and vomit it. So pleasure can be good. But here's what I want you to do. After church, I want you to go home, and I want you to take a 5-gallon bucket of honey, and we're going to eat that for lunch. Now, the first spoonful is going to be great. After that, it ain't going to be pretty, the Bible says, just a few minutes later. So entertainment, decompressing, it has its place. But learn to create that area after a time of greatly laboring. Proverbs 27:17 says this. Proverbs 27:17 says, iron sharpeneth iron. And so a man, that's the wrong verse. Here it says, the full soul, I've been preaching for over 25 years. I've learned that if I do that, 27:17, take a number off, and it's almost always the verse that I need to go to. So I found it. The full soul loatheth and honeycomb, but to the hungry soul, every bitter thing is sweet. Now let's go back to children being run from the ball field to a birthday party. And then they're watching video games in between. And then when they get done from all that, they go home and they can play video games. They can watch your favorite show. Once again, the message of Christianity is about death. It's very coarse to their ear. And God says a full soul loatheth an honeycomb. Here's the point. What I see is a society that is given itself to entertainment. What I see is this. There's a deadness in their eyes. I see people that learn to live simplistically and decompress and have pleasure in small increments. There's a light in their eyes. There's an ability to enjoy that. And if we don't find this sense of balance, we're going to lose something in our spirits. Proverbs 24:13 says this. 24:13 says, my son, eat thou honey, because it is good, and the honeycomb which is sweet to thy taste. I thought this was an interesting proverb. It's saying there's some things in life you can enjoy, but in increments, obviously. And the person that will find balance in their life will learn to find a balance between work, going after a goal, not working so hard to the point where they put a strain on their spirituality, but they can also create a place where they can enjoy pleasure. Listen to this. Entertainment should be clean and wholesome. I don't want to participate in something that is contrary to daily delighting in the providence of God and the personhood of God. I think that to find balance and to shift our life around pursuing the providence of God and thinking about God, we have to think differently about wealth. Let's go to Proverbs 13 and verse 7. Proverbs 13 and verse 7. Proverbs 13 in verse number 7. There is that maketh himself rich, yet hath nothing. There is that maketh himself poor, yet hath great riches. So our particular company, we are in $3 to $5 million homes all the time. In fact, we actually just did a house for a person who actually was an actor in Home Improvement. It was pretty cool. Manny on Home Improvement. He also was in Santa Claus. He was driving the bus. And he's actually been on Mike Huckabee. He's just a fascinating guy to talk to. And he became a Christian, I think, about 15 years ago. So it's a pretty fascinating story. But we're in some homes that are $3 to $5 million homes. I think we just did a bid on a house that's 14,000 square feet. Now, do you know what a 14,000 square feet home is? It's only 10 of your homes, okay? Which means if you think that your home is hard to keep up, try 10 of those. And a lot of those homes aren't really kept up that well. We actually get to get on the roof and we go, man, they must not be taking care of this house. But the point being is this, is we go into homes where you think these people would be so happy. And you know what we feel in these homes? Deadness. Total deadness. And then we'll go into a home, it's a 900 square foot home, and there's a little old woman there, and you see a Bible out there, and you can feel a presence in that home that is so endearing. Matthew Henry said that family piety crowns family prosperity. There's a shine to the crown of prosperity when you're serving Jesus. Proverbs 13:7. Says once again, there is he that maketh himself rich, yet hath nothing. There is he that maketh himself poor, yet hath great riches. And before I started saying something that's going to tie into this, to find balance, we have to learn to say no to outside voices. Here's what we mean by this. I was once counseling a guy. This is what he said. He said, I know I live in a house that's a little too much for us. He said, but I don't want my children to be made fun of at school. I thought, wow, I don't love my children that much. But there's the point. I do love them, but it's amazing how outside voices are dictating the fact that people are willing to get into more debt than they can handle and more house than they can handle. There's a lot of outside voices out there, especially when it comes to materialism. As I said before, as a youth pastor, coach, parents are terrified in our day that their kid will feel bad or left out or inferior. Now, we shouldn't purposefully make our children feel that way. I've had a couple occasions in the last 25 years where I've lost my cool, and in every one of them, it's when somebody has not acted the way they should towards my children. So I believe there needs to be a balance towards this. But I will say this. Parents are terrified that their children will feel inferior or feel bad. And here's the point. I mean, I can feel it in coaching them and the kids and talking to their parents that we're only delaying the inevitable. Because guess what? Life is going to make your children feel bad. And somebody is going to talk down to your children. Somebody is going to make them feel inferior. Now, once again, we need a balance with this. We need to lift up our children. We had one particular coach, when Josh was 5, he was like screaming his guts out at the kids. I'm like, yeah, you can see you got cut from the high school baseball team. And reliving his high school career. But what's interesting, or somebody's watched way too many coaching shows which have nothing to do with reality. Because the truth is, I don't care how good you coach, if you don't have good players, you ain't winning. That's all there is to it. You can give all the speeches you want, but unless you have good athletes, you ain't winning. Mike Krzyzewski said, great players make great coaches. He's exactly right about that. And that's why these college coaches go for the Adidas deals to get these guys there to the school. But anyway, what's interesting is this is you're only delaying the inevitable. Now, we need a balance in this. You got to protect your kids. We pulled our kids after three seasons from that particular team. We said, we're not dealing with this. This is not the spirit of Little League. But when someone has not invited our children to a party, here's our rule. You don't get invited to a party, start your own. That needs to be the rule. You don't get invited, start your own party. Don't let that person's shallowness and narrow-mindedness dictate and be the god of your own emotion. Start your own party. Now, we're only delaying the inevitable. But those outside voices can start driving how much a dad will work, how much debt a family gets into. And that's not just rhetoric. I think that is definitely the truth. Your children come home. I was at Tommy's house. He's got a jet ski. And I'm thinking about appreciating versus depreciating assets. I know how much money that dad makes. And did he charge it? Did he pay cash for it? I'm thinking about all these things go through my mind. I'm like, well, go ride it then. Break down his jet ski, okay? So here's the point. Is those things, they can start to drive us. And we lose balance. I just talked to a guy called Kelly Sexton. Kind of crazy money paradigm. He's one of our customers. And he operates a hedge fund. Who does that? He's the overseer of a hedge fund. This is what he told me. He said, the poor work for money to buy things. He said, the middle class work for money to buy things to look like they're rich. He said, and the rich work for money to invest it to make more money. But I thought it was interesting. He said, the middle class work to buy things to look like they're rich. I thought that was pretty fascinating. Pretty good point to make. Now, one of the things that we need to do is look for balance indicators. Give me just a few moments here. Balance indicators in our life. I found that if these things are in our lives, that's why I played basketball. If these things are in our lives, and by the way, they say in high school, you'll never use sports again. They don't know what they're talking about. I have towels fall off my shoulder, and I can catch them behind my back. I use sports all the time. I'm faster than any window cleaner we've got because I can slide in between the windows, and they're too good for that. So I tell Adam all the time, I say, you're going to see why I'm the owner, and you're not on this job. But anyway, I can't believe I just did a basketball slide in front of you. But anyway, I'm 50 years old, and I can still do it. But balance indicators. I found if these indicators are in our lives, we're on balance. If they're not, we're out of balance as a family. One is this. Are we being kind and tender-hearted one towards another? Kind and tender-hearted one towards another. I need to set this up a little bit better. So I think every business has to have balance indicators. One of those is direct profit, obviously. I have somebody who come to me and I say, we had $10,000 gross this week. I'm like, did you make money? That's gross. Let's think in terms of net. I've met a number of people that said something to the effect of, I got to go out to eat with these guys. They're the top real estate investors on the southeast part of the country. I'm like, and why are they eating with you? And the point being is this, is that going to make you more money? I don't care all your smoke screens. Are you going to make more money? Businesses have to have balance indicators. Are we operating in the black? Are we moving towards the black? Well, as a family, we have to have balance indicators. And the biggest one I look at is, are we being kind and tender-hearted one towards another? Ephesians 4:32 says, be ye kind and tender-hearted one towards another. That's the first thing that goes if I take my focus off that daily delight in the God of heaven. That's the first thing that goes in our family. Be ye kind, tender-hearted. It was a little easier being kind, tender-hearted to four girls in a row. But three boys that you don't even want to know what goes on in this room throughout the week. Oh my goodness. You don't even want to know what goes on in here. I came in the other day and I said, what are you doing with these tables and chairs in here? And they've got castles built and they, oh my goodness, it's unbelievable. And it tests my patience at times. So there's times where I don't necessarily want to be kind and tender-hearted, but it's the number one indicator for me as a Christian. Number two, are our words edifying one another? God says in Ephesians 4 and verse 29 that our words are to edify and to build up. Let no corrupt communication proceed out of your mouth, but that which is good to the use of edifying. See, I've got to go back to Winston Churchill's statement that he said before Parliament. If you ever want some good comedy, listen to Parliament. But he said one time before Parliament during the war, he said, if we cut funding for the arts, then what are we fighting for? And in our quest of making money and operating as a family, if we can't be kind and tender-hearted, what are we fighting for? If we can't build one another up, what are we fighting for? Big balance indicator number three. Are we eating together as a family? In some form or fashion, your family needs to eat together. It's biblical. Revelation 3, Genesis 18. God's whole illustration. Now, I realize you start getting young adults. I know what it's like for all of my children to hit young adult at the same time. You're like, where's everybody at? Where's everybody at? And then people ask me, where are they at? I'm like, I have no idea where they're at. So I understand that pressure. But Jesus compared sitting down and supping together with fellowship with the church. And as a family, I believe it's biblical. I believe the pattern set in scriptures. I believe it's natural. Are we eating together as a family? Number four, do we have 4 to 5 nights a week as a married couple that we are alone and connecting, maybe not even talking, but we're in the same place together? If not, your marriage will grow apart. It will grow apart. I used to actually take all these things for granted in couples that I counseled that they were doing these things. And I found that these are the top 6 to actually go away when the family gets off balance. Listen to this. Give me just a couple more minutes. Are we enjoying this level? So if you're involved with sports these days, everything's about the next level. Everything's about the next level. And remember, what if you want to define travel ball is this. It's an expensive way to find that your children have normal athletic ability a little quicker. Okay, that's how I define travel ball. It's an expensive way to find out that your children have normal athletic ability a little bit quicker. We get about 5 more families in this church, and I'm going to have to stop saying those things. I'm going to offend somebody. But listen to this. Are we enjoying this level? Everything's about the next level. You got little 5-year-olds who are just sitting out there literally picking up flowers, and the dad's like, I think they had a good game here. And 2 seconds after the game, the kids are talking about nothing but Legos. And everyone's about the next level. But are we enjoying this level? What are we fighting for? What are we living for? Are we enjoying each other? Are we enjoying the blessings of God? Lastly, balance indicator for us is, are we serving others as a family? If we're just making money, if we're just surviving, that's one thing. But are we serving others as a family? Why are we making this money? Why do we have business if we're not serving others as a family? These 6 balance indicators, if they're not in our lives, I have found in counseling families, something's off. Something's wrong. And I'll tell you, it takes extreme care, in my opinion, for us to maintain balance in this world. As the water rushes in at our feet, as the plane turns, there's a spiritual vertigo, emotional vertigo that we start to get. We don't know what's up. We don't know what's down. And we have to have a fixed sight on the providence of God. Thank you.
joy.